One of the great privileges of a institute like this, apart from meeting so many new friends, is meeting so many of my old students, whom at various times I've called victims and other things, but now I regard them as friends, and I'm so glad to see so many of them here. Today, I want to continue with you the line of thought which we were pursuing yesterday. And I had come to a place where I was discussing what is generally known as the New England theology, which was a serious departure from the historic Presbyterian position. Now, why was it a departure? Because it denied the essential element of the historic Presbyterian and Calvinistic position, namely in regard to the doctrine of election. It was a form of Arminianism, the same type in form and essence as we met in the Synod of Dort in 1609 and 10, so 18. I mentioned to you the camels yesterday, but within the ranks of Presbyterianism, the New England theology took a particularly important form. Because it originated in New Haven at Yale, it had a respectability, intellectually speaking, and theologically speaking, that perhaps the movement associated with the Camelites could not possess. It came out of the heart of New England intellectual superiority, according to the New England people. I will come to Mr. Finney a bit later, but right now I would call your attention to the impact which it had upon the church and to the split between the old and new schools of 1837. The cleavage between the old and new school elements came to a head when charges of heresy were brought against Albert Barnes, whom I mentioned yesterday. He was pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Philadelphia and held a very important pulpit, which he used to full advantage. He held that the Bible does not charge men with crimes of which they are not guilty, and does not say that the sinner is held to be personally answerable for the transgressions of Adam or of any other man. Or, and note this, that God has given a law which no man has the power to obey. In essence, that was the position of Albert Barnes. Now, here we see the inevitable tendency in all of Arminian thought to do what? To go much further than the mere denial of total depravity. To go to the next step and to change the law of God, that is the biblical doctrine of God and His law, in accordance with their views of the nature of sin and of the atonement. You see, you cannot tamper with the doctrine of the election logically and not be forced to change your views of God, man, sin, and the atonement. And in the New England theology, which Barnes imported into the Presbyterian Church, we see this tendency at work. And it was, of course, a very dangerous tendency. Barnes admitted this. He did not deny it. And he was facing proceedings against him, but he was acquitted by his new school brethren in that particular Presbyterian. Later, after this event, in 1836, he published his commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, in which, in his discussions of Romans 5, 12 and 19, he openly repudiated the doctrine of original sin. This brought the crisis to a head. And again, 10 charges of heresy were leveled against him, and the case, of course, went from Presbyterian to the General Assembly of 1836. And he was no doubt guilty. There's no question of his guilt. He admitted it. But Barnes was not the only cloud on the ecclesiastical horizon in Presbyterianism. At the same time, a noted New Englander by the name of Lyman Beecher was charged also with heresy. He was a disciple of Nathaniel Taylor, and I should have mentioned his name. Nathaniel Taylor was the originator, well, one of the originators of the whole New England theology. And Lyman Beecher was from New England. He was kin to Harriet Beecher Stowe and all the other Beechers and Stowes in Boston. As a friend of mine said, Boston has three great beliefs: the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and even more importantly, the neighborhood of Boston. And Barnes, Beecher, he's a bursting man. He was born in 1775. He died in 1863. And Beecher, who was at Lane Seminary, as a matter of fact, he'd accepted the chair of theology at Lane Seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio, became the instigator of most and many of the radical movements of his day. So that in a minute I'm going to show you, this Arminian tendency was not confined simply to what we call the more narrow circle of theology. It had very broad ramifications. He was brought to trial. Well, at least I should say the old school preferred charges against him, but the charges were dropped. And so Barnes also was cleared of all heresy by the same General Assembly of 1836, which cleared Beecher and Barnes. And the old school got disheartened by their successive rebuffs and their attempts to purge the church of heresy. But it also alarmed the old school. And so in 1837, I don't have time to go into details, the split came. Now, this split was a very, very important event in the history of Presbyterianism because it split along clearly defined theological lines, which was not true in the old light, new light split of the previous century. Not only was it along clearly defined theological lines, but also along geographical lines. When the split came, the Presbyterian churches of Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia and Alabama and Florida and Mississippi were almost all old school. There was almost no new school theology in the states I've mentioned. Now, I pointed out to you today that the fact remains, you see, transcendentalism had not hit the South. It did not infiltrate the Southern churches. The result was that when the split came, the Southern churches were solidly Orthodox. Now, I do not mean to imply there were no old school people in the North. Princeton, the great citadel of old school theology in the North, remained sound. It could not do otherwise with the impact of the Hodges and the others who were on the faculty at that time. But the split came. And this split, of course, had tremendous ramifications for the Northern Church. Now, having said that, let me go back and take up with you Brother Finney. Finney came from New York, from a district known as the Burned Over District. And it got its name because it had been burned so many times by so many revivals that it was practically impossible to sow any Christian seed and reap any Christian corn out of that section. The ministers called the Burned Out District. It was a home. It's unbelievable how many movements had their origin in that particular area. Joseph Smith, of course, he emanated from there. And when I was studying American intellectual history, the professor lectured, you know, I forget what one of you said the other day, that it was a sect and that they had a new revelation, which is certainly true. But he claimed that these books fell down at his feet and tables of stone. Moroni, my professor said, they didn't fall at his feet, they hit him square in the head. Well, that's a pretty accurate description of Joseph Smith and the movement which he led. But you may not know this, but this is the birthplace of the Kellogg Corn Flakes Company. It was the product of the Seventh-day Adventist group, of course, who do not eat meat, and as a meat substitute, Kellogg searched around furiously to find corn flakes, other breakfast dishes for them. But Princeton was fighting a battle, and in the West of that day, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, under the impact of Lane Seminary, and other schools later founded, the Presbyterianism was weakened in the Middle West, seriously weakened, because this split was never, never stopped. It continued. Now, let's go to Mr. Finney. Mr. Finney began his career as a lawyer. And at his conversion, he decided to use his legal talents, such as they were, for the Lord. And by the strong power of legal argument, not to mention some powerful oratory, he was going to convert people. Now, he is extremely important, not only for the history of Presbyterianism, but for the history of this country. He was, and I would agree, a very powerful evangelist. At that point, I would not disagree with what others have said. I was totally astounded when I found that Moody Press and Erdman were printing and reprinting his lectures on evangelism and his other works. Now, when I was doing some writing for a gentleman, Dr. Gary Long, I did two chapters for a book he's bringing out. My one chapter assignment was the history of Arminianism. It grew to two chapters, and two very bulky chapters, and I think he at first was a bit nonplussed by my writing such length. But when I got into it, I couldn't stop. And I came to Finney, and I had to tell the truth, because I read Finney. And Finney came to a position where he believed that conversion is a self-engineered project. Now, the Holy Spirit stands by to give you a prod if you seem to falter. But he really doesn't have much of a role to play. You convert yourself. And how do you do it? Well, Finney was the original evangelist of the American type. He was the one who developed the Sawdust Trail. He developed the mourner's bench. He developed the advanced publicity. He developed the extravagant use of the music. He developed walking up at the end of a service and committing yourself to Christ. And he developed the very emotional appeal which has become the stock and trade of most evangelists. Now, why did he do it? Finney was even more radical than Nathaniel Taylor and Albert Barnes. He really believes that man saves himself and that the evangelist is a social engineer who begins and guides the process of social engineering in the convert. Thus, you need all, and I hate to use this, I don't mean to be flippant, but you need all the tricks of the trade to do it. Now, he didn't have colored lights, and he didn't have TV, and he would have been a show on TV. Undoubtedly, he was a showman. He was apparently a pretty good lawyer. Now, I'm not saying that he was not a Christian. That is not mine to judge. I am saying that he did great harm to the church. He cheapened evangelism. And he cheapened the preaching which was used in evangelism. He cheapened the music which was used. And he misused it. In other words, so far as I am concerned, he was, humanly speaking, a disaster for evangelism. I've often been tempted to, I've never done it, because I don't like to be mean and nasty, but I've often wondered how Moody Press would answer me if I were to ask them why they reprint his messages on evangelism and his work writing. I don't know. I don't understand it. But I would say this, that we have never recovered from his impact on evangelism. And he was the product of the New School thinking. I grant you he went further than Nathaniel Taylor. I grant you he went further even than Albert Barnes. I would not deny that. But he was very, very dangerous. And modern evangelism, not all modern evangelism, but modern evangelism as a movement has its origins in him. You've been to meetings, I'm sure, where you sing just as I am through 10 verses, and sometimes 5 verses, 3 times each. So it comes out to a total of 15 verses. And the emotional appeal gets louder and louder. Last October, I was a guest at a certain educational convention speaking, and my friend, my host, we wanted to go to a prayer meeting on Wednesday night. So we went to a certain church on the outskirts of town on the main highway, and they had an evangelist there, and they had an evangelist quartet there. And the evangelist preached for about maybe 45 minutes. And the evangelist gave the appeal. This is a true story. And we stood in our benches for one solid hour. While we didn't sing "Just As I Am" one time, or two times, or three times, but you figure out how many times you can sing it through over a period of an hour with intermittent appeals, while they came up. By the time they were done, it was a congregation about three times as large, and they were all crowded around the front, and my friend and I were sitting back over yonder, back where you are, and we were deserted. Everybody else was going up. My friend, who was a fine Christian man, turned around and looked at me and says, "We're the pagans in this place." It did feel sort of funny, but it was an emotional appeal. They had young girls come up sobbing that they had been nasty to their mother that day and before they went to school and that sort of thing. And it was a highly emotional meeting. But there had been very, very little gospel preached. I wouldn't say none. I would say very little. Now, this is the end result of what I'm speaking, about what I'm speaking. I would have you note something in regard to the history of evangelism. And I want you to think about this. Do you know the last effective, prolonged evangelistic outbreak and revival outbreak in this country? It has not come in the 20th century. The last one came in the Confederate Army in 1862. It was prolonged right straight through the war, and it was prolonged after the war and added great stimulus to the struggling Southern Presbyterian Church. And it undoubtedly prepared the soldiers of the Confederacy when they returned to their broken, burned, whatnot homes to withstand the storms of the days of Reconstruction. I can't give you a pinpointed date as to when it finally died out. I don't believe anybody knows. But it had a tremendous impact on the Southern Army. And when they went home, it had a tremendous impact upon the South. Now, I'm not saying that there have not been effective campaigns. I'm speaking about effective revival in its deepest sense. That's the last one. If you go through the 20th century and you think of the many, many revival movements and campaigns we've had, I am not saying people are not saved. I'm not saying that from I am saying that in their total impact, they have not had the effect that that one had upon the nation or even a large section of the nation. This is one of the sad facts of our day, and it is very compelling to think about, that certainly from 1930 on down, Christianity has had less and less impact on national life in this country than it had had in the 19th century. In spite of the radio, in spite of the TV, in spite of the great evangelistic leaders who have come out, the impact of the church on this country has decreased. Now, I'm not unmindful of the moral majority which is making itself felt today. But this is the first time, I would say, I'm not either condoning or condemning, I'm simply making a statement of fact. The appearance of this force in American life is the first time in memory of most people that such a development could take place in this nation. And it's due to the dire problems which we face and the critical situation which we face today, as you and I are meeting here. Whether it will have a tremendous impact, I do not know. But it's the first time anything like this has come forth. But I would say this, that on the whole, it has not been the product of the great preaching and the great work which produced that revival in the 1860s. There's a very fine book, Dr. Jones' book, With Christ in the Camp. And if you want to read it in detail, get Robert L. Dabney's Life of Stonewall Jackson. He was on his staff, and he had some vivid descriptions of the revival efforts in the Army, of which he was a participant, and in which he took part and which he observed. And if you know anything about Dabney, you can never imagine him preaching a sermon that didn't run the gamut of the gospel in at least an hour and a half of his preaching. Now, In 1860-61, a movement, of course, began known as the War Between the States. And this was contemporaneous with and concurrent with the formulation and the organization of the Southern Church. Now, this was a tremendously important event in the history of Presbyterianism. Let me say right now, I still love that church. I love its history. I love many people in it. I have tremendous regard for it. And I've done a great deal of work in its history. It's had, for 80 years or so, a glorious history. What were the motives? What were the real motives behind the split of 1861? Were these motives a little more than a temporary acquiescence to the political divisions and to the passions of 1861? Or were they more fundamental in their nature? How many of those today who argue for the reunion of Northern and Southern churches understand what was really at work at that time? You hear the arguments, there's no reason why they should remain apart. Perhaps from the point of view of contemporary theological outlooks, there might be some basis for such a judgment. But from the point of view of what the Southern Church was all about, there is all the reason in the world to remain apart. Let me say emphatically, and even E.T. Thompson will grudgingly admit this in his History of Presbyterianism in Volume 2, slavery was not the real issue. There was a fundamental issue way behind that. There are many arguments which can prove this. One of them is this, that Dr. Dabney and Dr. James Henry Thornwell and others were not in favor of slavery. And yet they led the movement, which either would conclude that these men didn't know what they were doing or that there were other forces at work. The slavery issue was not the issue. And if you go back and read the work of that assembly in Augusta, you will see this. The issues were theological and theological implications. I pointed out to you that the South was completely, almost completely, old school. The North was spotted. There were strong old school men. We would gladly admit that. But the Northern old school lived in the same arena, although they were separate because of the division of 1837. They lived and worked in the same philosophical arena in which the new school was living. They were subjected to the same political, economic, and social, and intellectual pressures. And when the war came, the old school in the North abandoned its old school position and supported the so-called Gardner Spring Resolution, which called upon the Presbyterian Church in the North to support the federal government. Now, for that day, to call upon a Presbyterian Church, which was not under the state, to take a position in favor of any government was unthinkable. And this produced the final blow. It wasn't just the Gardner Spring Resolution per se, but it was the thinking and the theological pressures behind it. And if you read these men, and I have Dabney right now on my table at home, I've been going through him very carefully, I've gone through and annotated every page of Thornwell's 4 volumes, so I'm not speaking off the cuff from what somebody else says. I think I know the minds of these men. I would hope so. And I don't mean to say that the others were not important. They represent the crystallization of the thinking of the men who formed the PCUS. Some years ago, John Oliver invited me to preach in the First Church of Augusta. And when I got in that pulpit and I saw that moderator's chair over there on my left-hand side, and you could feel the history dripping out of the walls and from the ceiling, it was quite an experience just to occupy a pulpit of that netted old church, which is such a beautiful structure that day, and just overwhelming. Now, I'm making a point that one of the great high water marks of Presbyterian history was the emergence of the Southern Church. For the next 80 years, give or take, It was not only an ecclesiastical force in the South, it was a theological force in the South. The work of Thornwell at the University of South Carolina long outlived Dr. Thornwell. Dr. Dabney's work in Virginia Union long outlived Dr. Dabney when he left to Texas. However, as we come to the post-war period, we have problems emerging. Now note, I pointed out to you that Arminianism had reared its head in the New School. It had gained great ground. I haven't had time to go into all the details, but when the war was over, Darwinism came to this country. It had actually come in 1861. Asa Gray had written a review of it for the Harvard Review, that's Darwin's book. But once the war was over, Darwinism swept into the North and became, within a very few years, an amazing intellectual force. And one by one, except for Princeton, one by one, the Northern Methodist, Baptist, and Presbyterian seminaries, notably McCormick, and notably Lane at Cincinnati, were yielding to its pressures. It entered into the universities. William Graham's son, teaching at Yale, taught 10 generations of college students. He was an out-and-out social Darwinist. Lester Frank Ward was an out-and-out social Darwinist. He taught his students. And Darwinism became the basic economic and social principle underlying American intellectual life after the war. And the Presbyterian Church did not remain immune to it. So that after the war was over, Darwinism took over. I would suggest, if you ever have time, to read Jacques Barzon's book, Darwin, Marx, and Wagner. It's in paperback, and I highly recommend it. This is the one book I know which brings out so clearly the philosophic connection between Darwin, Marx, and Wagner. It's based upon the literary correspondence of these three men. You may remember that Marx dedicated the first edition of his Das Kapital to Charles Darwin. Marx and Richard Wagner, were in constant communication. Wagner, in his Magic Cycle, has great operas that are so highly celebrated, wrote those operas for the express purpose of transmitting Darwinian thinking into the Teutonic strain of German musical and intellectual thought. They both admitted their debt to Darwin. Darwin admired his proteges. This is a very, very valuable book. I think it's out in paperback. I think I remember seeing it. It's a tremendous piece of work. And for those of you who want to understand the sinister work in evolution, far beyond the confines of a scientific theory, into the very warp and fabric of American theological life, I would strongly advise you read that book. Because radicalism became the order of the day, and Arminianism led the way. Now, I dearly love something that Dr. Packer said one day this week. I do not remember what day it was, but that doesn't make any difference. The point is that once you have Arminianism, a trail of disaster follows in its wake. You cannot hope to maintain inviolate a doctrine of inerrancy. You cannot hope to retain inviolate even a Christian ethic. You cannot retain inviolate a Christian view of man, God, and the world if you surrender any point of historic, biblical, Christian, Calvinistic theology. No way. And the history of the church in this country after the war, particularly after 1875, is a history of steady retreat, steady regression. And while it began in the Methodist and the Baptist churches and in the Episcopalian church to a certain degree, it soon made its way into Presbyterianism. And we were caught in a movement which produced not only theological decline, intellectual decline, but it also produced a growing radicalism. So that after the war, the Christian ethic itself was being lost. Oh, there were books written about it, but what were they doing? They were sanctifying, or at least attempting to sanctify, a pagan ethic. They were attempting to come to terms with a Darwinian conception of life. They were attempting to come to terms with a Darwinian conception of government. So that by 1900, the church was heavily involved in areas it had no business to engage in. And out of this came the ecumenical movement. And, of course, in this, the Presbyterian Church became involved. Now, we're now dealing with great moments in Presbyterian history from an entirely different angle, and that is the decline of Presbyterian vigor, the decline of the theological vigor of the church, therefore the decline of the church. I want to make that very clear. It's extremely important. In 1908, the Federal Council of Churches was formed. It immediately issued a social creed. That creed was written by the same man who wrote the Methodist Social Creed in the same year. That man, at that time, was an intellectual communist. Later, he openly became a communist. Now, I do not mean to imply that all those who joined the Federal Council of Churches were communists. That is not true. Neither were they all social radicals. That is not true. On the other hand, the movement behind it was, and many good evangelicals were drawn in the movement, thinking it was a great way to have the churches gain force. Curiously enough, if you read the documents, which I have read, you will find that they were very much interested in forming a united Protestant voice against the Roman Catholic Church. By 1940, that had all changed, and they were eagerly trying to invite the Roman Church to join it. And, of course, the National Council of Churches kept the chorus. I'm not trying to advertise the book because the stock is exhausted, but I wrote the Unholy Alliance, which is a history of the Federal and National Council of Churches. Unfortunately, it's not now available. It's out of stock, out of print right now. So I am pointing out to you that the Presbyterian Church USA took a lead in the formation of that council. It was not the only one. The Methodists played probably a more important role. But certainly the Presbyterian Church USA did play an important role. And that began the movement to incorporate Presbyterianism into the movement known as the Social Gospel. Now, here we come to the great problem of the 20th century, which had a tremendously damaging effect upon Presbyterianism. You see, the Social Gospel as a movement became wedded to the ecumenical movement, as that was found in the Federal Council of Churches. And the Federal Council of Churches was founded to expand and to implement and to strengthen the social gospel. Now, not everybody who joined it was aware of that fact. I'm not for a moment saying that they were all guilty of this. I am saying that many of the leaders in the formative denominations, notably the Presbyterian Church USA, the Northern Methodist Church, the Northern Baptist Church, the Congregational Church, knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew why they were doing it. And we need to keep that in mind. So by 1908, then, with a social creed at hand to guide them, the Presbyterian Church went into this thing. Now, in the light of the radicalism of the day, I would admit that the social creed of 1908 looks relatively innocuous. And even some parts of it had some merit. But what did it represent? It represented, first of all, the intrusion of the church into national affairs. The very thing the Presbyterian Church U.S. had repudiated in its fight against the Gardner Spring Resolution of 1861, and rightly. So that it represented the second place, not only the intrusion of the church into national affairs, but it represents the intrusion of the church in national affairs on a basis in which it was surrendering its basic doctrine. Within a very, very few years, Henry Van Dyke, well, he had already done so once. Henry Van Dyke was leading a movement in the Northern Church to remove the doctrine of infallibility of Scripture and to soften the doctrine of election in chapter 3. Henry Van Dyke was a liberal. He was a very persuasive liberal. And he was already at work trying to get the Northern Church to soften its stance exactly in the way that Albert Barnes had tried to do in 1830-35, which led to the split between the old and new schools. So that we're right back again to where we were as a church. Now, the Southern Church did not join us then, but it did later. The point I'm making now is that the whole ecumenical movement, the whole social gospel movement, by its nature, had to surrender the sovereignty of God in terms of human sovereignty. It had to deny total depravity. It had to deny the biblical doctrine of the atonement. It had to deny the nature of the death of Jesus Christ. It had to deny the nature of the church. It had to deny the nature of sanctification, as my colleagues so ably brought out this morning. It had to deny these things because it was steering a course in which sanctification would now become part of the good works of the social gospel, in which the church would no longer be the voice of God to a dying world. It would be the voice of sociology to a world that needed sociological and psychological care. And the church would be used to render that service. Now, in the few minutes that are left, and I see the time is fast going, will you let me depart from my text a minute to plead with you to, not only as pastors, as elders, and as obviously intelligent laity, or you wouldn't be here, to understand the great issues of church history. If you look at the 19th century, you see the panoply of events and trends which would come to a fruition in the history of Presbyterianism in the 20th century. If you go back to the creed of the Council of Nicaea and the whole Unitarian movement as exemplified in the debates of that council, between Arius and Athanasius, you see the whole movement of doctrine, and you see it once. As you go back there, you'll see heresy rearing its head. But if you go through the history of the church, it does it again and again. But it does it under such pleasing and alluring terms. If you see the social gospel rearing its head, people today will deny, "Oh, we don't mean what they meant in 1933 or 32 when they adopted the new social creed by the Federal Council." They don't mean, "Oh, but they do." And the result is the same, because all these movements are based upon the same denials which the original movement was based upon. All you have to do is to read the pronouncements today of the National Council of Churches. All you have to do is to read the Christian Century to come to that point. Now, what does this tell us? Christian history, the history of the church, tells us that if the church is not on its guard, it runs a tremendous danger of accepting the social, economic, and political demands of the world as those identical with the demands of the gospel. In other words, it runs a tremendous danger of accepting a secular ethic as the Christian ethic and of allowing the world to dictate what the church should do and its ethical implications in life. And if you look at the recent history of the movements in this country today, you will see that this is the case. I am very, very fearful of the movement known as the New Evangelicalism. And if you look at its documents and what it is saying, you will see why I am. I do not know how many of you are familiar with it, because it was given very, very low key. But in November 1973, at a meeting in Chicago, a group of evangelicals issued a document which was popularly called the Chicago Manifesto. Now, it was a call to Christian action. I should say social action. And it was signed by some leading evangelicals, some of whose names surprised me. Others, of course, did not. But this new evangelical movement and its social pronouncement and its endeavor to make the church socially conscious, which is good in itself, but has accepted the radicalism which emanates from communist and neo-communist structures. And we attempt to give them a Christian flavor, a Christian covering, and what we've really done is to accept a whole ethic which is born of modern radicalism, and therefore must be, by its very nature, contrary to the gospel, contrary to the belief in the sovereignty of God, to the total depravity of man, to the redemption through Jesus Christ alone, through his blood, and all the great doctrines which we hold dear. Now, I don't mean why all these men deny this. They don't. But the program, the philosophy which they accept, has these implications. Now, tomorrow, in my closing lecture, I'm going to take the split in the Presbyterian Church USA, the emergence of the Orthodox Church, the controversy in foreign missions, the formation of Westminster Seminary, and the rocky road of modern Presbyterianism since that day, closing with perhaps a very brief word about the formation of the Presbyterian Church in America. That's a long, long agenda. I probably won't make it, but at least I shall do it. So I thank you. Maybe close in prayer. Our Father, our God, as we look at the history of thy church, O Lord, fill us with deep thanksgiving for those who have gone before, who have struggled so diligently to preserve the faith, to make it meaningful and effective in our own lives and that of the nation. And so, O Lord, wilt thou enlarge our own horizons, wilt thou make us aware of the legacy which we received. And, O Lord, may we pass it on, unblemished, for the future of thy church. And so we pray this with thanksgiving. In Jesus' name, amen.